endroit qui est assez enclavé. Donc de cette façon-là, donc on avait donc ces vélos que les gens vont pouvoir utiliser. Les vélos vont être stationnés à différents.
Radio rebroadcast from the 3rd of March 2022. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Amandla This Week at CQUT 90.3. Amandla Radio is brought to you by Doug Miller and Gwen Schulman. We are offering you news, analysis, and insights about Africa that you won't get elsewhere. This week, of course, the focus is on NATO and Russia and the Ukraine. And that's totally normal, since that's all we can hear about anywhere in the news. And, of course, it's an outrageous, egregious situation. But we at Amandla stand solidly behind our comrades at Échec à la guerre. Just to remind you, Échec à la guerre was formed as a result of coalition building during the 2003 protests in the dead of winter when the United States was attempting to push its NATO allies to join it in its illegal and extremely bad occupation of Iraq. Thankfully, we had enough people out across the country here in Montreal, over 200,000 in the dead of winter, cold, and at other cities as small as London, Ontario, had 50,000 out, and the government had no choice but to not get involved in the Iraq war. Instead, it took us to Afghanistan, with NATO, I might add. And then, of course, NATO's record in Africa, with Libya, with Somalia, we know all too well, in America's AFRICOM, what it's been doing all over Africa with drone strikes going on in Somalia as the war goes on in Ukraine. And NATO has been behind all of it. Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine, reads the statement by Échec à la guerre. Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine must stop immediately. Real negotiations must begin to ensure the non-expansion of NATO to Ukraine and Georgia and the implementation of the Minsk Agreement as a resolution to the civil war that has been going on in the Ukraine since 2014. No one would justify Russia's aggression and invasion of Ukraine. It is clearly a violation of international law, and is typical of aggressor states. It's been draped in humanitarian motives, just as the allies of the United States have done and many times since the war, the Second World War. NATO was formed at a specific time, and while there are so much going on, well, there are so many commentaries in the media about the war in Ukraine and how outrageous it is, no one is mentioning the fact that NATO, over the last 10 to 12 years, has been 929,000 deaths, 38 million refugees caused in the war against terrorism. United States and its allies have blatantly and egregiously and illegally invaded Serbia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria, and not one of their leaders, the Bushes, the Cheneys, the Rumfleas, the Blairs, ever been sanctioned or had any legal proceedings brought against them. So we've seen what's going on. The United States, as the leader of NATO, holds the key, reads the Échec à la guerre a press release from yesterday. The United States, as leader of NATO, holds the key to a quick outcome to this war, to announce that NATO will definitively renounce its request for Ukraine's membership and commit to a neutral status for that country. But this would be contrary to everything NATO has been concocting for years. And for the moment at least, this war suits them well. It helps to establish their new orientation of strategic competition with Russia and China among all NATO allies, to justify the pressure to increase their military spending and strength. strength, to increase their deployments in Europe, to consolidate their fear and their role in protecting Europe. So we at Amandla stand right behind Cheka Leger. They have organized a protest. We hope you will all come out in large numbers on Sunday at 1 o'clock at Parc La Fontaine, where Charrier meets Parc La Fontaine. So we will proceed now with our show. The show tonight is taken directly from a broadcast put together by Africa is a Country, a website we highly recommend to you. We played something from them last week, and this week it's they've put together Are the Russians Really Coming? As a podcast about how Russia and Africa, how Russia is intermingling with Africa, how is Africa responding to the invasion, and how is Russia investing itself throughout Africa. So stay tuned to Are the Russians Really Coming? By Africa is a Country.
Welcome back to the Africa is a Country podcast. I am your host, William Shawkey, and you are listening to Africa's a Country's venue for discussions about current affairs on the African continent from a left-wing perspective. We're available on whichever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. Please subscribe as well as give us a review. Tell us what you think. Give us any feedback. We appreciate all of your support and all of your criticism and encouragement. So today, now I think it's important to mention what day we are recording this episode. It is at the moment Thursday, the 24th of February. And I just want to read a little excerpt from an article that we published on Monday, the 21st of February. It was written by our founder and editor, Sean Jacobs, and provocatively titled, "The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming." Sean asks the question of, where do African countries fall in the threatened invasion of Ukraine by Russia? Will African states side with the US or with their European allies or with Russia? Now, today, that question is no longer academic. It is live. It is pertinent. Russia has invaded Ukraine. And many people are wondering, what does that mean for the continent? So joining us on today's program to help us answer this question is John Lechner, who is a former financial analyst, now a freelance journalist. He writes on the politics and languages of the former Soviet Union, Turkey, and Africa, with a special focus on the Central African Republic. He speaks Russian, French, Turkish, Georgian, Chechen, and Sango. Pretty remarkable. He recently graduated from the Master of Science in Foreign Services program at Georgetown University School of Foreign Services and is a contributor to Africa is a Country. So, John, thank you so much for making the time to come to the program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I think the most logical place to start is a question I've been bombarded with today from friends, family, just anyone I encountered throughout the course of the day is, given what's just happened, which is Russia proceeding with its invasion of the Ukraine, why? And if you listen to sort of mainstream media or talk radio or whatever venue it is, a lot of the rationale for the invasion is kind of simplistically being reduced to Russia's protest against Ukraine being included in NATO. Which is not the whole story. So to ask you to answer a big question at the beginning, sorry to throw this at you right away, but yeah, just for our listeners, and especially our listeners on the continent who maybe have not been as clued up to the issue now, because for a while it's kind of had this existence on the periphery, at least while the buildup began at the start of the year, but now it feels very, very real. Why? Why has Russia done this?
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, thanks again for having me. I'm a huge fan of the podcast and a huge fan of Africa as a Country. And so it's an honor to be here with you today. And thanks for starting off with a question that I will inevitably fail to answer correctly. I think why are we seeing large-scale military operations today? That's a question that I think a lot of experts, a lot of people who are much smarter than me and really specialize on the inner workings of Russian politics, Vladimir Putin's leadership, his regime, his inner circle. It's still what happened today. I still caught, I would say, most people off guard. They did not see these types of large scale military operations, targeting of outside of Kiev, major cities, deep within inside Ukraine. They did not see this as a possible outcome, or they saw this as a less likely worst scenario. And I think it's become increasingly clear that the worst scenario was the plan all along. We're seeing ground invasions, likely with the outcome of trying to topple the Ukrainian government, likely installing a Russia-friendly regime, and what I think would essentially mount to an occupation. So those were all things that people were expecting as a worst case, most extreme scenario, and that's what we're seeing now. So I think for everybody, this is a very humbling moment in time, because it's clear that many of us actually don't understand why these actions were taken. So with that being said, as you said as well, it's impossible to say that to whittle it down to just a simple binary Ukraine and NATO, not in NATO, and that's why Russia invaded. There's probably several reasons for it, NATO being one, that the Russian state has over time seen the expansion of NATO as a threat. It also is the fact that Putin and within Russian, Putin's ideology to in general, there's a belief that Kiev is the original seat of Russian culture, where Russian culture orthodoxy began, and therefore Ukraine itself is a natural component of Russia, and that the separation between Ukraine and the larger Russian state is a false one, one that has come about with the machinations, as Putin said in the speech of Lenin, and then in the Soviet Union, and that these borders are inherently false. Beyond that as well, you likely have, as one of my colleagues has pointed out, Seva, that you have a personalist autocratic regime that and within personalist autocratic regimes over time, over 20 years, the circle surrounding the leader gets smaller. The ability for good information to reach the leader, non-biased, open information becomes increasingly scarce. And you find yourself in an echo chamber where certain become much more rational. And it's likely that Putin and some of the people who are providing Putin with information are overestimating the welcome that they're going to receive from the Ukrainian population, of both Ukrainian and Russian speakers, by the way. They're probably underestimating the costs. And as with any war, every war starts with a one side being more optimistic than the other. And so what we're witnessing now, I think, is a mesh of many things and reasons that have changed over the decades too. But there is no one reason. Those are just a couple that we can posit.
That was tremendously helpful for an answer that caught you off guard. So thanks for that. And I think people will really appreciate that. And you said something which I think is especially resonant for me about how all of this is a very humbling experience, because our efforts to try and approximate a rationale for why this is all happening have proved in vain time and time again. And I think, you know, you're right that really the lead resource to try and know what's behind Putin's mind is what Putin says. That speech on Monday, I think, is as close as we'll get. And I read a really good analysis of that speech by the political theorist Branko Milanovic, which I'll direct listeners to. But thinking about that theme of not really being able to get at what motivates Putin's machinations and Russia's broader sort of political maneuvers. When it comes to the African continent, there's a similar line advanced as to why Russia is involved in the continent. And we'll get into the specifics of its involvement in a moment. But just to give a sort of sense of it, I want to read a paragraph from the piece that Sean wrote on Monday, where he says, Russia's presence in the continent is growing, especially militarily. Yes, that means mercenaries. The Associated Press recently published a map showing Russian mercenaries in nearly 20 countries on the continent where Russia is operating. Those include Libya, Guinea-Bissau, Guinea-Conakry, Nigeria, Chad, Sudan, South Sudan, Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zimbabwe, and Botswana. So we get a kind of picture of Russia's involvement on the continent in one form or another as being vast. And over the years, this has been attributed to Russia. Similarly, China's portrayed in this way as trying to expand its influence on the continent, trying to export its political ideology and bring African countries under its network of control. And in your writing, you've said it's a little bit more complicated than that. Could you tell us why?
Sure. It's another very big question.
We don't shy away from the big questions.
Absolutely. So, yes, I think there are a couple of narratives that kind of almost knee-jerk narratives that have historical precedents in the Cold War, especially, and even further back to colonialism, which see, I mean, you don't even have to be very nuanced about it. You literally see different analysts describe what's going on in Africa now as the scramble for Africa 2.0 or something along those lines. I mean, those are clear historical references to colonialism and following colonialism, the Cold War. And so these kind of very simple narratives of countries like Russia spreading or seeking influence for influence's sake without ever really defining what influence actually particularly means. It's a word like stability. It means what the speaker or the listener means, but it's rarely defined. These kind of simplifying narratives really mask the nuances behind it, because I think that they ultimately imply that there's some sort of master plan behind Russia's presence in Africa. And we tend to, when we define or we otherize who we consider to be an enemy or a threat, we have a tendency to overestimate their abilities and their agency and their ability, the level of control that they exert over events, which we normally wouldn't ascribe to ourselves. And so when we talk about Russia and Africa and we show these maps, which maps can be as helpful as they can be deceiving. So I think especially with that AP map, is it really worth covering a whole country that can be the size of France in red if there's 200 mercenaries there? It implies a level of control on a map that is it's far beyond usually the realities on the ground and what the terrain permits. So I think in general, the problem that I have with those narratives, to go back, would be that they fall back into those simplified Cold War policies and of containment, of a need to counter for the sake of countering without ever really defining what one's own interests are in a particular country.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, thinking about some of those interests and who's wielding them, something that I think is striking about what a lot of your writing addresses is just the extent to which Russia's involvement on the continent is very privatized, which is to say that it happens not through any official channels. It's not state sanctioned in the way that one would expect a campaign for influence to go. And Russia's attitude seems to be happy to let its sort of oligarchs, and I put that in scare quotes because I think you know, something that's come up throughout the week is just the way in which portraying sort of Russian capital as an oligarchy is itself a kind of otherizing tendency. But it's happy to sort of let those affiliated to the party state to get involved in Africa, and a chief way in which this involvement has manifested has been through mercenaries, and it's kind of concentrated to a number of actors. This one guy that you speak about, who's the owner of the Wagner group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and his got a footing in the Central African Republic and other places on the continent. So why has this become the sort of primary form of involvement in Africa? Sort of military cooperation. It can hardly a cooperation really, but military involvement for.
Sure. I think one of the more simple answers, I think, of why mercenaries and not another form of military operations would be that it's not important enough from a Russian perspective. And again, that's another issue, I think, with the overall Russia expanding in Africa. I think, as you said, individuals have a lot of leash when it comes to operating in these environments, and they have a lot of leash because it's not a massive priority for the Kremlin. And so for that very reason, you see mercenaries and not necessarily actual Russian military personnel who are participating in this. But at the same time, I do think that we need to differentiate as well each area. Mm-hmm. And so Libya has a different priority than the Central African Republic. Libya is closer. We're talking about the East Mediterranean, ports. The only other port that Russia has available in the East Mediterranean is in Syria. And so Libya's importance from a state perspective is going to be very different than the Central African Republic. We can't forget that the Central African Republic is it's either 188 or 189 in terms of the least developed countries in the world. It's at the very bottom. It is not something that keeps Vladimir Putin up at night. I think the level of equipment, the level of talent that you will see will differ depending on the level of interest involved as well. And so in a place like the Central African Republic, unfortunately, you often see equipment that breaks down, perhaps not the best, most highly trained of people showing up. But I think the kind of the summary answer is that rather than show the importance of Africa to Moscow, the presence of mercenaries is interesting because it actually shows the limits of their interest, the boundaries, the boundaries of their interests, that they're willing to sacrifice, or maybe not sacrifice, but they're willing to tolerate the potential for embarrassment, the potential for issues that might arise with the presence of mercenaries, but no further than that.
What I find interesting about it is that, once again, to problematize the overarching kind of Cold War narrative, it seems as if for a lot of these private actors, the straightforward motive is accumulation, is profiteering, and doing so cheaply and quickly. As you say, the technology and equipment that is transferred is often unreliable, but it's of no interest to them because it's a way to make a quick buck. And this has me thinking back to an interview I did with Professor Xiaoyang Tang about China and Africa, where I think, you know, China does have a little bit more of a strategy, but even then, the strategy is straightforwardly driven by political, economic, and material interests. It's not some effort to try and aspire to great power influence, but to make money and expand the places where you make money, which in ultimately is actually consistent with theories of imperialism. That's the primary reason why imperialism takes root is finding more places to make money. And that's primarily why Russia why Russia, through all of its people and companies connected to it, is on the continent.
Yeah, it's a great point, because I think it is primarily to make money, but we shouldn't over exoticize that as well. I think any U.S. State Department official would also say that one of their key jobs is to open up trade for U.S. goods, to markets and things along those lines. A lot of the Russian presence in Africa has nothing to do with mercenaries. I mean, it's very run-of-the-mill. I mean, maybe not run-of-the-mill from a average person, you and me perspective, but I mean, if you work in oil, you work in the gas sector, if you work in these types of industries, a lot of what they do is what a lot of other companies do: look for new look for new oil fields, look for opportunities for Gazprom, for Rosneft, for Lukoil. Why is this important? It's important for the same reason that things are important in other countries as well.
This, what you're listening to now, is a rebroadcast from Amandla's radio from March 2022, just after the Russians had invaded Ukraine.
Big companies employ lots of people, and they have an out, as in the United States, they have an outsized role in deciding foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And so what can be probably a little bit more unique about Russia, and I take your point on not trying to over-exoticize or otherize Russian capital as oligarchic, but you do have perhaps some unique scenarios where you have individuals who are both the heads of large state-owned enterprises who also have the ear and outsized influence within foreign policy as well. And mm-hmm. so you also might have what at the end of the day is probably a more personalized version of other phenomena that we see very typically with French interests or US interests or things along those lines, but they're just embodied perhaps in an individual as opposed to a group of individuals. And so for that reason, I think it can be often very difficult for us on the outside to make a judgment on what is the interest of an individual or of a private enterprise that is run by a specific individual and what is the interests of the state, because these things can be a little bit more mixed, perhaps, or more opaque, perhaps, than in other countries that are more, will receive more transparency. Let's put it that way.
Just to make a quick digression on that exact point, read two good pieces this week. One, written by Sam Green, I think, on his Substack. And it was basically saying that, well, Russia's main beef is not with NATO, but with the EU, because further European integration, which is basically what Ukraine seeks, and using NATO as a backdoor, kind of threatens the Russian model of capital accumulation, which, as you've said, is very clientelistic, patrimonial, and personalized. And if Russia has less immediate spheres of influence, it has less immediately accessible sites of accumulation, and itself would be forced to kind of pursue a developmental model along the lines of what the European Union represents. And a similar piece by John Gantz on his Substack kind of making this argument. But that's a quick digression. Coming back to the relationship between Africa and Russia, what I think is maybe another unique thing, and this is where I'm interested to hear how this works out, is that in as much as Russia on the one hand is happy to have a kind of disinterested attitude in what its entities get up to on the continent, at the same time it views sort of just general increasing Russian presence on the continent as reinforcing the idea of Russia as a great power. So mm-hmm. it might not be sort of consciously seeking to cultivate its image as a great power and do so along lines which portray it as straight and narrow, but mm-hmm. views it as somehow kind of achieving that. I think the one word you use in the piece that you wrote for War on the Rocks is that it helps it achieve the desavnost, which is great power mm-hmm. status. So how does, I mean, once again, this is us trying to sort of enter the minds of Russia, but how does it figure its ability to both simultaneously kind of maintain this fairly blasé attitude, kind of uninterested in the repercussions of that, but at the same time, it contributes to the idea of Russia as being a great power.
So I'm super glad that you asked that, because as I was talking earlier about the narratives, I was realizing that I was forgetting a couple of the main points that I wanted to say. But so how does that work? I think in multiple ways, and the most important thing, and another key point that is missing from the kind of Cold War 2.0 Russia expanding for the sake of expanding, is that we have to ground Russia's presence in each African country in African agency, in especially the agency of local elites and the local government. And so in so many of these instances, it's not actually Russia expanding into a particular country. It's actually local elites who are reaching out to Russia, because they think that by reaching out to an outside power, they're able to better consolidate, better position themselves within whatever domestic political issue or struggle they currently find themselves. So ultimately, when we're talking about this, I mean, all geopolitics is ultimately local. When you get down to the local level, it is local actors who feel that they can gain some sort of advantage over competitors by reaching out to or leveraging outside help. And so we saw that in Libya with Haftar. We saw that with Touadera in the Central African Republic, that he felt his position was weak, that there could be a potential coup. He reached out. We've seen that most obviously with the current regime in Mali, that they've been seeking to, that they've reached out to offset French interests. In Sudan, it was Bashir who reached out to the Russians when he was nervous that he thought that American influence was seeking to undermine his rule, and so he thought he could counterbalance that with the Russians. And his offer of a port obviously fell on very welcome ears. And so for every push factor that there is, there's always a pull factor too. And so Africans themselves, and especially African governments, are major actors in whatever Russian presence you might be seeing. And then to the concept of derzhavnost, or this kind of ideology, or this sense, this idea that Russia is a great power, and basically looking to find ways to constantly reify that fact that it's a great power. I would say as well that a lot of that is not necessarily special as it pertains to Russia. So if we take, for example, where I live and work in Washington, D.C., you have the U.S. government, which sets essentially the bookends of what is possible in American foreign policy, it's never written down, but what is okay and what is not okay. And then you have a lot of companies, a lot of individuals who then within that kind of national security infrastructure try to make money. And the way that you try to make money is by showing that your project is supportive or in the interest of the national interest.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what kind of ironically, it would be Russia itself who would be interested in that Cold War Russia narrative, because it's the individuals who want to show that what they are doing, that they're, yes, they're making money, but they're making money in the national interest of Russia.
Mm.
And so it's a very, again, it's a very complicated kind of push where all actors are creating and recreating narratives to kind of define what the interests are.
Mm.
But those narratives are never just a top down. It's not set by Putin and then everybody else tries to figure out what it is.
Mm.
People underneath are also trying to establish what the narrative is and figure out how they can make money within that.
Mm. And this push-pull dynamic, I think one large factor for why, as you were just describing, local elites are undergoing, your word for it was extroversion, sort of trying to curry favor with Russia, is that the presence of the West, which includes France, the United States, the EU, is on the continent, is a story of retreat, basically. They're kind of withdrawing, either in, oversimplistically throwing their hands up and kind of and dismissing the continent as, once again, as this hopeless place where stability is illusory and it's just too chaotic, and the Sahel is a ticking time bomb, and they want to get out of there as quickly as they can and don't want to be involved, and they're just going to wash their hands and be on their way. That's kind of very much the sense that we're getting now. And some of this is itself the outcome of local pressures. So the growing anti-French sentiment in the Sahel, for example. And so as this retreat is happening, local actors seek greater collaboration with other foreign actors. And in so doing, find a meeting of the minds of sorts. So, it occurred to me now that this wave of coups, which is now a sort of recurring topic on the podcast lately, because we're trying to grapple with, what does this mean? It's sort of given a new lease of life to anti-liberal sentiment on the continent. So in very broad strokes, seeing the return of arguments which are critical of liberal democracy tout court often. So it's never kind of liberal democracy as the vehicle through which neoliberalism happened and economies were devastated, but almost a kind of an argument intrinsically protesting liberal democracy conceptually and what it means, and at the same time kind of indicating a preference for strong arm regimes. So it seems like that's also another place where you give Russia a place to kind of enter and be in natural alignment with a lot of the people seeking their entry, because Russia also wants to encourage, maybe not in any kind of any kind of overactive sense, but is similarly anti-liberal and similarly pushes that worldview.
Yeah. Well, I think, it's a very interesting time right now. And I think, especially when it comes to the Sahel, one of the major, and I wrote about it in that piece, one of the major criticisms that Western countries lob at Russia or Chinese or the Chinese presence as well, and the Chinese government in Africa, is that they support autocracies and illiberal forms of government. The problem with that, of course, is that so has the United States, so has France.
Exactly. Yeah.
Obviously, that doesn't cut it. Like people can recognize that hypocrisy, and so the United States and France have made a lot of, especially since 9/11 and the war on terror, have really paid lip service to democratization, especially in areas where they've been particularly concerned about jihadist movements and extremism, for the simple fact that they would have preferred the stability of an autocratic regime to what would be, I mean, we have to face it, democracy is actually inherently unstable. Competitive elections. They are conflictual. There might not be arms, but it is an unstable environment. Obviously, the stability that autocrats offer is often very surface level and ethereal, but there's always been kind of a preference for stability, which in reality just means status quo, which in reality always meant the authoritarians who are already present. And again, same issue as before. Local governments were able to take advantage of the new discourse, which was the war on terror, just as the new discourse is becoming great power competition, to reach out and receive more support from outside governments, because all of a sudden everybody has to be the bulwark against Islamic extremism. So there's a long, long history of this extroversion, obviously, and it's not my idea. It's a very famous theory that Bayakh wrote about in the 80s. But I think that those issues, the fact that at least since the war on terror in the Sahel, Western governments have paid lip service to democratization, and it hasn't really resulted in the bettering of ordinary lives in the Sahel, that you see a very natural response to it now, and one that some of these leaders have recognized as an opportunity to take advantage in kind of these populist coups.
So, I mean, what glimmers of hope are there that things could be otherwise? So in a lot of the writing, for example, the Financial Times recently published an article about a brewing catastrophe in the Sahel. That's its title. What its sort of prescriptive comment is to say that the only way out of this powder keg of unhelpful foreign interference is for the EU to play a more positive role and encourage meaningful democratic initiatives that reinvest power in the hands of the people. And in other places, it almost seems like the alternative is to hope for a strategic transformation on the part of the West, to say that rather than pursuing retreat in the face of its abysmal failure to achieve anything by being in the region for reasons that you've just outlined, where it's similarly also propped up autocracy, it should come back and do the opposite. So, but that seems, you know, I mean, on first flush, that seems awfully kind of over-optimistic, so to speak. So, I mean,
yeah,
what might be another way? And as I say this, of course, the way we do want is one that is driven not by states and elites, but by the people themselves. But you know, that's always the hope for actual politics and organizing at the grassroots level to determine this. But as far as the actors that could create an environment for that sort of thing to flourish, who are they, and what signs do we have that they might want to do this, that it aligns with their interests at the current moment?
It's such a tough question, because the overall structures that are in place that render some countries and some people always the interveners and others the intervened are so overwhelming and difficult to change that I'm not sure there's any specific, really any intervention that would be possible that would the interventions are in themselves a symptom of this overall system, and so you can't cure the system with its own symptom, I guess would be, I don't know, a bad metaphor for it.
I think it works pretty well. I think you should write that down. But,
so there's a couple of things that I think are important. And Nathaniel Powell just had a great piece on what did in War on the Rocks on what did the French do wrong in Mali, and the answer was a lot, but I think one specific issue that really resonated was that one risks ignoring the perceptions and the priorities of locals at one's own risk. And so for France, one of the original issues was that they prioritized the groups to fight that were more important in their minds, which was the various jihadi groups, whereas they did not listen to the Malian authorities, who actually viewed Tuareg separatism in the north as big of an issue as the extremist groups in other parts of the country. And so when you get these mismatching prioritizations and you're not listening to the local perspectives of people, your interventions are always, at least from a security basis, are always going to wind up ineffective or wind up getting kicked out like France. The other example is I just came back from the rural Central African Republic. And in most places now, security is actually improving. And in pretty much everywhere, not everybody, but a vast majority of people are actually very happy with what the Russians are doing. And that's because they view the security situation and the major problem in the country as the presence of armed groups. That is the most important issue for them. And with the Russian PMCs and with partnering with the Central African Armed Forces, retaking most of the country, that is, from the absolute majority of people's perspective, a very good thing. And to see now the rest of the world concentrate really only on the Russian presence and not on the armed groups which are just as bad, if not worse, mm-hmm. you're absolutely missing what locals want. And it's absolutely going to result in some sort of gigantic misunderstanding, which has already occurred in Carr, and which we saw occur again in Mali. And so any of these types of interventions have to recognize that your security priorities might not actually be the local security priorities.
Which I think gets at a fundamental misalignment, which is that the security priorities for locals, as we've seen as the main kind of impetus for these coups, is security, is for the basic rise and detra for the state to exist. And whereas for the West, its security priorities refracted through their own geopolitical economic interests. And so I'm curious to hear why it's the case that Russia collaborating with the Central African Republic government has led to a more effective relationship. But it just seems that if those mercenaries, just hide swords and they're there for you to tell them how they can help and what they can do, then things get done. But maybe that's just an oversimplistic way of putting it. But maybe
it's not. I mean, I think, I will be the first one to say that if the Central African government partnering with Russian mercenaries results in a modicum of a return of stability and an ability for Central Africans to just start returning to somewhat normal lives after essentially what's been 15 years of instability and an entire decades of lack of presence of the state, then that's absolutely a good thing.
Well, that wraps it up for Amandla this week. You've been listening to Africa is a Country broadcast podcast entitled Are the Russians Really Coming? About the current situation in Ukraine, Africa's response to it, and in current situation with Russia investing itself throughout Africa in different ways. We encourage you to denounce this unjust war that's going on in the Ukraine, but to denounce NATO as well for its provocative behavior and outrageous denial of its own guilt in so many invasions and occupations around the world, Libya amongst others, in Africa, Somalia, Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq, of course. So we encourage you to come out to the Shekele Ger rally, the demonstration to protest this unjust war on Sunday at 1 o'clock, Parc La Fontaine, at the Cherry corner, and to be there in large numbers to take Canada out of this stupidity. That's it for Amandla this week. I'm Doug Miller, wrapping it up and saying good night. Stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium.
You have been listening to an Amandla radio broadcast from 2022. Produced by Africa is a Country, and it's Russia and Africa.
Good night, Montreal. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. It is very soon going to be 8 p.m., and you're listening to Jazz Euphorium. We have an excellent lineup for you tonight, and we will be starting you off with I Want to Talk About You by Ryo Fuki. Thank you.